almost didn't hear you there. These machines can be quite loud at times, and these tunnels don't make for that great of a soundstage either. While you're here, would you mind handing me that little rectangle on the ground over there? Ah, some iron. I'll use this to upgrade. Ah, those blasted things again. Don't they have anything better to do than to attack my small little dome? Anyways, let's head back to fend off those creatures. We can talk some more over there. I think there's also a guest guide.
Hi there, I'm Yves, and in today's episode of Open Indie, we are going to talk to René. René, please introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yeah, of course. I'm René, I'm 34 years old now. I'm from Dresden in Germany, and I have a company called Bippin Bits. And the company also has another employee, which is my wife, Anne. And together we like to make games, and we now made our first, like, proper commercial attempt after many years of fiddling. That game is called The Dome Keeper, and it got pretty popular, which is also the reason I'm here today.
We're very happy that you could make it here. We'll also talk a little bit about your studio later, but let's stick to Dome Keeper first. The official release for Dome Keeper was 27th of September this year on Steam, if I'm correct.
Yes.
To paint a small picture to our listeners, since we are an audio medium, could you just describe a typical round of Dome Keeper for the ones who have not tried it yet?
Yeah, of course. You're thrown right into the game, and you see yourself kind of crash landing on a planet, and then you have this little character sitting in the dome. You start moving, and you quickly figure out that you can go into the underground and mine for resources. These resources you can then bring back to your dome. In the dome, you can buy upgrades with those resources, for example, to mine better, but also to improve your defensive capabilities, because every 1 to 2 minutes, a wave of monsters comes and attacks your dome. And after you've beaten that wave, you go back to mining. And that is the thing, that's the core loop that you do over and over again, switching from mining and defense. And the defensive part gives reason and purpose to the mining, because then you are in the situation that you really need those resources to stay alive. And you're always in this conflict of, okay, do I improve my mining? Can I? Are my weapons sufficient right now? Do I need to push the weapons? So that's always, there are always a lot of decisions going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can also find some fun things underground that spice up the gameplay.
Yeah, a lot of fun things. One thing that stood out to me was the satisfying gameplay loop. I think you've heard this by now dozens of times, but the blend of digging, defending, upgrading your dome is right down my alley. And I think the success that you guys had so far with the game, I'm not alone with this feeling. How hard was it to balance all of these aspects of the game?
I feel like it was strangely easy because originally, we made this game in a game jam in Ludendare 48. That was in April last year. And so we made this game. Back then, it was called Dome Romantic. And we made it in 3 days. And it can still be played on itch.io. And if you do, you will see it's essentially the same game. It has a very similar timing. It has a few of the monsters we have right now. And it already brings in this feel. Because when we made it in the game jam, we got the feeling, okay, this works. The core loop is tight and people enjoy it. And we took care never to mess with it too much, to not destroy the thing that works. So that was kind of existing from the beginning. And then it's only about scaling up and playing and testing. And that's more about just what feels right, because difficulty needs to ramp up. But I feel like all that came pretty naturally.
You already had a solid foundation with this game jam basis, and then now it's more like keeping the core and not trying to disturb this core gameplay too much by adding more features, etc. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I'm also sure what helped a ton with this feeling natural was that we were doing playtests basically from the first day, right? The game jam is a big playtest, and then after we added some new content, we opened the game up for playtests in our Discord. And if you get constant feedback on every change you make, you are iterating so much and always adapting and changing. So you never wake up and see the game, okay, that it does not work at all. It kind of flows in small steps. That was always fun to see, like if we do a month of intense playtesting, and then we would do a patch each day. And with each patch, the game would get better. And after 2 weeks, it would be way ahead of what it was 2 weeks before, thanks to the great playtesters we have.
Yeah, shout outs to them, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
While playing Domekeeper, I saw a lot of gameplay influences from different genres. You have like this tower defense aspect in it. You have the roguelite aspect in it because of the gameplay loop. Because when you do a run, after you finish a run, successful or unsuccessful, you kind of get to carry over some of your successes and keep progressing on a meta level with some more features that you can unlock for the next run. And also this digging aspect, so exploration, etc. Which games influenced gameplay and art decisions for Domekeeper?
When we made it initially, so we didn't think at all about another game when we made the core concept. Because in the game jam, the theme was deeper and deeper. So a mining game was very straightforward. And I also did not really play any of the mining games that people come along and say, hey, this reminds me of Motherload, or this reminds me of SteamWorld Dig. I didn't play those before. And for some of them, I knew they existed because it's a relatively simple design, right? It's very straightforward. It feels like it doesn't need a genius moment to come up with that. It's very straightforward. For me, it's very strictly a roguelike. Because this meta progression, in the sense that you get better with each run, like in thousand small steps, that doesn't exist, and that's intentional. For some people, they miss that, but that's the core of it. So it's really a roguelike. And I was also surprised to find that so many people equated with a tower defense game, because in a tower defense game, you build a lot of towers and they fight autonomously, but of course you have this feeling of those waves. There were definitely big influences on me when I think about games. Like every game I ever played kind of influences me, but also especially those that I enjoyed very much, but also maybe even more so the game designers behind those games, because many of them are also vocal on podcasts, and I listen to them for many hours and just learned a lot and follow their steps. A few influences, like direct game influence was Kingdom, which is also published by Raw Fury, because there you also have this wave-like structure, and that feels very good to me to have this emotional balance between that, or also so that you have a stressful phase and a calm, pleasant phase. Also with the music, we are doing a similar thing of having sparse music. Maybe a game like Into the Breach was also important for the overall progression and what you can unlock. That was one thing I was thinking about. And with the new keeper, you can also see that exemplified, because Into the Breach, from my understanding, with each squad, they try to really spice up the gameplay. So you have to kind of unlearn what you know so far and do things just very differently with each squad. And that's something I took to heart when thinking about new keepers or new domes.
That's a very interesting point. Also something that I wanted to mention, because you already said that you were constantly patching the game, not only when it was still on itch, but this tradition, I would say, still continues up to this day. Looking at your Discord channel, basically, you're almost always in Godot working on the game.
Yeah.
When you look at the patch channel, it's amazing what speed you keep up by adding new features and by fixing bugs. And especially looking at the new keeper, the assessor plays completely different than the engineer.
Keepers are definitely the most challenging element to design, because when designing them, I'm thinking about how can a keeper be different in three areas. One is the mining itself. How do they destroy rocks? The second is how do they carry resources back to the dome? And the third is how do they move? And so ideally, I can vary things on all three levels. And that makes it the most complex thing to add. And then, as you say, balancing is one thing. Like, I think we can find a balance that kind of works out. We get a lot of feedback. We can adjust how powerful the upgrades are, how expensive. So we can eventually come to a good spot, I think, and start with a balance that's already kind of decent. But the big challenge we see there is also, how can we make it very different, but also bridge the gap so it stays simple enough, people can understand it quickly and don't get totally frustrated when coming from the engineer. Because right now we are seeing some parts of that, like people who want to play the assessor like the engineer and get frustrated. So we kind of have to nudge them in the right direction of, okay, you have to unlearn things.
That's something that really stood out to me when the update was released. I immediately jumped onto it. started with the Assessor, and at first I felt reminded of Breakout, I would say, so a little bit from the concept. It was really cool to see, and what really amazed me was that with the Assessor I really had to get used to a different playstyle. I think one thing you guys also did really well is you are not bombarded with a lot of tutorials about stuff. So it's really the exploration, not only about digging and finding your three resources, but it's really also exploring, okay, what can I do? How can I do it? What's my overarching goal? And everything is not really spelled out for you in text boxes or whatever, but you really naturally pick up the controller or your keyboard, jump into it, and you intuitively know what to do.
Yeah, that's like the ideal situation, and it's also difficult to achieve. Like in some way, you always have to teach the player how to play the game, or even better, if you can build an opportunity for them so they can learn it on their own. That's kind of the better scenario. And the easiest thing would be to have a pop-up that says, hey, this thing works like that. And now have fun. That's like the easy route. And we are also doing it for some things where it would be very difficult to teach all of that through gameplay. We could probably do it, but we would need kind of more infrastructure, like a training level or training situation. Overall, this comes out of two things, I would say. One thing is the our game jam background, because in game jams, people generally, you can assume that people won't read your text boxes and won't read an explanation. So if you want to do well in a game jam, people have to be able to get into the game and just start playing and figure it out along the way. So that was one learning, and that also just feels good. And the other thing is I really, really dislike tutorials. In every game I play, I never read the tutorials. I disable everything I can because it's also very fun to get to know this game on your own speed and get on being able to figure out how things work, especially when it comes then to, okay, what strategies can you follow? So that's just a personal thing. And so I try to minimize how many explicit tutorials there are.
And when gaming was really getting more complex, and you had basically learning levels sometimes where you could not progress if you did not click this specific button.
Yeah.
In the early game, when it was released on Steam, Dome Keeper, the first thing I unlocked was the Sword Dome. And I think this was the only time where I was like, okay, how do I use this? So I put the sword next to the guy who was banging on my dome to defend it, and I was, oh, why doesn't he take damage? Why does he keep hitting? And I think with the next update already, you introduced just two text boxes. So what? You have to swing the sword to hit the enemy, and then it was, makes sense.
We had this little front-loaded video tutorial pop up just with a little bit of text that shows you, okay, this is what the Dome can do. And for the release, I didn't manage to update all the videos, so it was missing on release. That was a little bit of a blunder. And what also, so normally the idea of the loadout screen was that you would already see how the thing works. But for the, also another thing I didn't manage to put in before release, animations for the Sword Dome. So in the loadout screen, the Sword Dome did just not do anything. And now it swings and it steps. So you could just from the loadout screen understand what it does because you see it happening. And if that's the case, maybe we can omit the front-loaded tutorial. You said before with the tutorialization, okay, if you need to follow a tutorial where you are forced to click on specific points, that will not teach the player anything because they will often just click the stuff. That's not how learning works, right? You have to apply.
If you learn something and I managed it through skill, it's always better than someone told me, press this button, I pressed the button and continued on. Before the release on Steam, I want just to shortly dive into this as well. You mentioned itch.io, where the Dome Romantik is still up. In February, I think this year, you had the game up on Steam for the first time on the Games Germany event.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And a second time around came for the Steam Next Fest in June.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about the feedback you got from there?
So in February, we released essentially the improved Dome Romantik. It still had the old graphics. It had a lot of the new elements we were working on. And we released that just on a whim as a demo on Steam because we were in this Games Germany event. And I saw, okay, yeah, you can have a demo up there. And I thought, yeah, okay, why not? We have this playable thing around because we're always doing playtests. And I essentially we published the thing I pitched with, and there it really took off. Wishlists are an important like one important thing to keep track of. And from April 21 to February 22, we've gathered, I think, about 1,000 wishlists and had 200 people on our Discord. And then the demo came out, was picked up by so many YouTubers. People loved it. People played it so much. Like some people played it for 50 hours, and we had like, 5,000 people played above 20 hours. So we just had a huge, awesome median playtime for a demo. Like four times the median playtime the other full game we released before has. So, and then we went until April, we went to 80,000 wishlists and suddenly had 5,000 or 6,000 people on the Discord. So that was really where it took off, and where we also understood, okay, it's going to be successful, at least in that way, that it won't lose money if we don't mess up too much. And then it was, and of course, that also got Raw Fury very happy, our publisher. And as a publisher, of course, you also have to look, okay, where do you invest more money and more time? And if a game is showing that people like it, it gets very easy for a publisher to say, yeah, okay, let's put more resources into that. But in the meantime, while we had the demo was basically old already, because at that time we were already working on this graphics upgrade we did between Dome Romantic and Dome Keeper. And that one went live in June in the Steam Next Fest. Then it was really the Dome Keeper demo.
You already mentioned Dome Romantic. Where did the romance go?
Yeah. I mean, that's always a thing in game jams. So sometimes, it goes 3 days, and sometimes on Monday night, a few hours before release of or finish of the gem, we suddenly realize, okay, we haven't given the thing a name, and suddenly you have to come up with a name. And yeah, I didn't want to do some names that sounded just very generic or cheesy, like Dome Defender or Dome Digger, something like that. And Dorf Romantik was popular, so we made a little pun on that.
You can't go wrong with puns, yeah.
But then the name stuck around way longer than I wanted. So in August last year, we basically decided that we would call it Dome Keeper. Then it got popular in February. Suddenly everyone was talking about Dome Romantik, where before like nearly no one knew it. And then in April this year, we finally announced the change. And then people were like, the old name was so much better. It had much more character.
You always have those.
Yeah, it's also fun. Like they found an explanation for why it is romantic in a way. Like you are alone on this planet, only in your cozy little dome, and you struggle. But yeah, the kind of the loneliness in a foreign situation has some sort of melancholic romantic thing.
Now that we made a small check mark behind the romance, back to the more technical things. You chose Godot as an engine, which I find really good. Cool.
Yes.
So props to that. Is there any particular reason for this choice?
Yeah, until 2019, I was working with Java and more like a library called libgdx. And I realized, okay, this is not the thing of the future. And basically, this has no editor, right? So you just have this library code you can call, but you don't have a scene tree and you don't have an editor of any way. So I thought, okay, yeah, it looks like a proper engine would be better in this case. I did a similar comparison years before when I decided for libgdx. There I also considered JMonkey engine, for example, because I wanted to stay in Java because I was learning that also in university. And then 2019, I took a look. I struggled a little bit. Even the years before, I knew a new engine would be good, but the transition is always hard. If you're proficient in one tool, switching to another that works very differently is a little bit hard. And I'm also not one of the early adopters, I would say. And then I checked Unity, which was a gigantic tool and slow and cumbersome. And I didn't like the idea of the like the abstractions in there were not great. Like it didn't have a component system that was good. And libgdx, I was using an entity component system always, and that felt like a thing to have because it's good. But in libgdx, it was also very buggy. I spent so much time just trying to work around strange stuff. And then I tried Godot, and I quickly understood that this is a great thing. Like it was small, it booted up fast, and then it had this wonderful component system with scenes and nodes that really allowed a great modularity. It was open source and free, and that was also important for me because this was only a hobby until this year, actually. So Godot quickly became something I wanted to invest the time in to learn, and I've never looked back. I really love it. It's a fantastic engine, and I think the best one if you want to make 2D games.
I don't have that much experience as yourself, but I'm also learning Godot at the moment, and maybe for our listeners as well. So as René already mentioned, Freeware Engine, you can go to the website right now just to plug them real quick, because I really think they deserve it. If you want to learn making games, this is a great start. They also have a real vast community, lots of tutorials, etc. So it's a real cool thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You already told us a little bit about yourself. Could you give our listeners a small idea when you started making your own games?
Yeah, I think I started in 2002 or 3. That's when I got my first own computer. And then I was allowed to use it more than an hour a day, because that was my limit before. So I wouldn't just spend all my time playing games. And I discovered a tool called Blitz Basic. And that was, yeah, you could program with Basic and make games relatively easily. And I immediately knew, like, this is super interesting. Programming is sounds like a great thing. Like, you just write words and you build a world out of nothing. That's a little bit magic. Yeah, I started to learn programming, which was also a very kind of frustrating and tedious experience, because I had no one who could teach me, or who I could ask. There weren't any like bigger tutorials around. There was one tutorial I followed, and eventually I saved some money to buy one Blitz Basic book. That was also helpful. But it's still a big jump from getting basically engine features explained to being able to make a game. And there I just spent a lot of time learning and improving, and made many, many small games that I can still check out today. It's all there.
Nice.
2007, I went to university, and I still used Blitz Basic for some years until I was good enough with Java. And then I, maybe 2009 or 10, I switched to Java, first with very, very bare bones with LWJGL, where you would really prepare all the little bytes and kind of manually push them into the graphics card memory. So that was, it was a different kind of work to even get a button in there, because I didn't use a UI framework. Yeah, and then I think 2012, I kind of nudged Anne into making pixel art, because I was making those games and I could not make art, and I kind of encouraged her to do some stuff, and she enjoyed it, but she didn't want to do it as much as I needed, and I always pushed her a little bit, and eventually she took a lot of joy from it, and now she loves it.
She's your partner as well?
She's my wife. We are married. We also have a kid together. So I did found Pip and Bits, and she did found another company in like that was closer to her ambitions, which is nutritional consulting for cats. So basically, if you have a cat and you want to feed it properly, she's an expert in that.
Ah, cool. My neighbors have a cat, so maybe I'll come back to you.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a whole topic of its own, and it's also interesting.
She's responsible for all of the pixel art and all of the graphics.
Yes, exactly. So I'm doing the coding, the game design, and also the production, because someone has to kind of bring it all together. And for audio, we didn't have anyone. We just used free audio most of the time. But in 2017, we started doing game jams, and that really helped us develop and grow as game makers. When Dome Romantic hit, as in the game jam, we quickly saw, okay, this is an order of magnitude more popular than the other games that were also popular enough, I would say. And then we kind of focused on that. And also the nutritional consulting took a step back. And now Anne is really a full-time pixel artist.
Also, I know you have a small team that worked on that Dome, but it's not.
Yes.
All of the components fit together. It's really great. And the art, the sound design, and also the gameplay.
Yeah. That's where we started. Like we made Dome Romantic together, like only us two, and it didn't have any music. And one of the players, Cameron, came around and said, hey, the game doesn't have music. Could I make some? And we were like, sure. And then it was fantastic, and it elevated the game. And he's around until this day and still making great music. And then we grew, and with the publisher money, we were able to hire more freelancers, like Martin for the sound and all the pixel artist talent we got now.
You heard it here again, dear listeners. If you're aspiring to become a game maker, go to Game Jams. Good things will happen.
Yeah, I can recommend nothing more than this.
René, since you already have so much experience as a games creator, are there any particular moments that you are really proud of?
That's a good question. So I think one real catalyst was us getting into Game Jams and going in there with the right attitude. So we didn't go in there to make a hit game or something like that. We went in there as a learning experience. And we were very critical of what we made and analytical and just analyzed and tried to learn as much from each game as we could. And I think that worked really well. And also the process of taking in player feedback and understanding that every bit of feedback is valid. And even like if things are factually wrong, they might still be perfectly right as a feedback because the game is not clear enough in that area, for example. And I think that was the biggest thing for us that went well, that we were able to learn there and just go in with the right attitude. So, and I mean, Dome Romantik was our 10th Ludum Dare. And so there's a reason it's not our second.
Share your work, improve on it, and don't expect a hit on the first try. That's why we are gamers. We always have continuous and extra lives. So use them.
I mean, there's so much around that, right? Not being precious about your game and accepting that it's releasing the first game is also a humbling experience because you try your best and then it might be okay and it will get some praise probably from some people, but looking back, it's probably a shit game if you look back after a few years. Hopefully you can say it's a shit game because you improved so much.
Yeah, I think it would be more depressing if you looked back after a few years and saw, okay, that was the best I made.
Actually, like the first game we made in the Game Jam, that was called Membrum. That was our first released game ever. And that was in 2017, I think. And this had the highest rating in Ludum Dare for innovation. So it got the 11th place in innovation and we never reached that again. So regarding innovation, we peaked with our first game. And that if you want to make a successful game, being hyper innovative, it might not be a good idea because a very innovative game will also be difficult to understand and tell people about because it's complicated and they cannot as easily relate to one. Like with Domekeeper, we have this advantage where we can say, yeah, it's mining and defense. And everyone who sees it understands what it's about.
Absolutely. I think it's also a struggle between innovation and scope. So there are a lot of things. If you just start out and say, okay, this needs to be the most innovative game that ever existed, the scope becomes larger, larger, and larger.
Yeah, scope is a really big topic of its own. I'm always a little bit sad when I see people get into game making and start with their dream project. Most people will stop eventually, but some will follow through and make it after 8 years or something like that. And it would have been a much smoother experience usually if they would have made 5 games in the first 2 years, learned a ton, and then made their dream game in 2 years or something like that.
Don't start with a massively multiplayer online game with multiplayer capabilities.
I will try my best to stop them.
Yeah, exactly. That's good. Since you already said game jams are an important part, now that Domekeeper took off, will you also be attending more game jams? Or do you say, okay, now we are in this Domekeeper loop and for now you put a break on that? Or is it still something you have planned in your calendar?
Well, absolutely. I will always try to do as many game jams as I can. And we did two Ludum Dares after Dome Romantik. We also participated. And the one directly after Dome Romantik, we made a game that was even more popular than Dome. So that could be a candidate for us to follow in the future. And the only reason we missed last Ludum Dare was that was basically our release week. I couldn't justify making a game jam game in release week, even though I tried.
You cannot tear yourself up to be in two places at once. You have to focus. Yeah. And this was an important week for you as well.
Yeah, I also felt I had this responsibility for everyone who worked on Dome or invested in Dome and all the community. I feel like, yeah, it was my duty is maybe the wrong word, but I had a responsibility to bring them the best game I could with the team.
So So, René, let's talk a little bit in our final segment about your studio itself. So the name Bibbenbits, is there any particular reason behind the name?
I'm wondering how old that name is. It might already be like 8 years. And it was clear, okay, when we want to make games, we need a name. And Anne was already involved with that. And I had a few ideas and she didn't like any of those. And she came up with Bibbenbits. And she was happy about that. And she said, yeah, like Bibbin, like happy little bits. Is that right?
Exactly. That's also the mental picture that comes to mind. Bibbenbits sounds really, I would say, uplifting.
Yeah, it's not like we make a lot of happy games. So I think we might have a more depressing stroke. Yeah, but it sounded okay. And it had a meaning and it's an artificial and short word. So that was fine for me, and I feel like that encompasses also like one thing we learned in game jams and follow through, like very little we do needs to be made to perfection. So the vast majority of things are fantastic if they are just good enough, because then we can save a lot of time and move ahead. And you also mentioned like our good pace with the updates and patches, and that's also a reason for that, because we don't spend weeks on things that are ultimately not important, and the name feels like that. So yeah, it was good enough.
If you think about it, a little contrast is also not too bad. As you mentioned before, your games are not that happy, and so but when the dev studio behind it or the dev guys behind it are, and also what you can see on your Discord channel, which I urge our listeners to join, because it's a really cool community over there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it matches. It just matches.
Yeah, so sometimes I wish I had a cool name, like the other studios, like Skeleton Crew or Brainwash Gang or Dukana Interactive. All these really nice names that are well thought out and branded nicely. But okay, yeah.
What you mentioned is quite typical. So for at least of them, it was really, okay, we made a brainstorming session and decided, but it was really, yeah, it just matched and we kept it.
Yeah.
René, one last thing I want to touch upon is you are a game studio in Germany. Could you describe the gaming industry in Germany a little bit for our international listeners?
Yeah, I think a differentiation is good between Germany as a whole and the reality we are in. Because in Germany, there's a little bit of industry. It's not a big game-making country. And I think that's also because of how well the government supports the gaming industry in the past years. Like you had all this government help in the UK and France and Canada. And then of course the big studios are there. And in Germany, there was not that much. And in the region I grew up in and I'm still living, there is nearly nothing here. So I didn't know any local game developers maybe 2 years back. And when I was starting, when I wanted to go to university, there was also nothing I could have really studied in that area. So I went and studied IT. So it was definitely a challenge. And as I said, as a kid, I kind of had to learn it on myself because there was nothing around supporting that. Also not much regarding programming. So that was definitely a challenge. But I don't know. We were just persistent about making that, and it's a passion and it doesn't stop when the situation is not ideal. On the other hand, of course, I'm very lucky in the sense that I was able to go to university and have a stable life and a normal childhood and education and such. So that's definitely not normal, I would say, for the majority of people.
And it's, I find it great that you appreciate it. Some people have it and don't appreciate it. That's the worst thing, I would say. But still, since you mentioned that when you started out as a games developer with this passion for games, that there was basically nothing. If you compare this to today with game jams, with the internet, of course, with the advent of you can talk to everyone around the world, you say the trend goes into the right direction, or where do you see room for improvement in terms of how the German government is funding you or supporting you?
Yeah, so with the internet, of course, the possibilities blew up for everyone. And you see that in the amount of games that get released. Like 10 years ago, I don't know, there were maybe 400 games a year releasing on Steam. And this year it will be 10,000 or something like that. And so everyone has a chance now, or most people have a chance now when they have internet. So that's a little bit of an equalizer, which is great. And for the other part, what the government can do to strengthen the local games industry is of course this grant system, and they started that a few years back from the government, that they had $200 million for 4 years to give out to game studios, and I feel like this was a big help for local studios to think about their funding and for them getting publishers, because the government will also help with financing project, which is very attractive. And I think that's really the right direction. And now it's very, very important that this is continued and strengthened, ideally, because the funds actually dried up in October. And then there was a big panic, like they dried up like more than a year before their supposed end. And if you prepare a year, a project, or work on a publishing deal, or you even have to secure the publishing deal or get a letter of intent or something like that, and suddenly they tell you, okay, yeah, no funding anymore.
Surprise. Yeah.
That's a catastrophe. Yeah. So that really needs to be a stable environment. And then, for example, now with this grant, my big incentive is to hire also local people. And this will help the game industry locally also, because I can only, like, if I have a freelancer from, I don't know, Poland, I cannot get the cost for him or for her supported by the government. It's only available for local people.
Yeah, and also I think it's a matter of stability and also security, because you took a big leap with your company, and in the end of the day, it's a company that you're running. But if the financial situation is somewhat not secure, it can be really hard. I think this is also one thing where the government needs to act as a stabilizer to make this industry thrive, because we need programmers. We need guys and girls who love to follow their passion, if they have the passion to create cool things and games. And this industry it's like the new auto market in Germany in a few years.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge industry and it's a waste of potential. Like the gaming, the revenue from gaming worldwide is larger than the revenue from movies and music combined, for example. So it's the biggest entertainment industry by far. So it's also a high tech industry in a way, and it's a big loss not to push that forward.
Let's hope for the best that in 10 years it will look better or keep steadily improving.
Yeah, I think we are on a good direction there. So we have the game association that pushes a lot of for a lot of change, and the politicians are also listening and doing some very good things. So I'm positive this will develop.
Looking back at the release of Domekeeper, are you happy how it turned out?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So so the release was very successful. The people, so there are, for me, I think there are two things I would look at, or maybe three things. One thing is how do the players rate it, and we are at 90% positive, which is more than I expected, so that's fantastic. Second thing is, did people actually buy it? Because our first game is at 100% positive, but it only has 20 reviews, which tells you, okay, no one bought it, basically. And on that area also, a lot more people than I expected bought it, so that's very good, so we can keep making more games. And the last thing is how happy I am with that. And that's probably the weakest area, because I have all these big plans with the game and all the ideas for content. And I wished we could have launched with more things already in, but there's just not enough time to do it beforehand, unless we want to delay the release half a year. And we thought, okay, we can do it now and add more stuff with all the feedback we are getting then. So it can be better now, but still I would have liked to launch with a little bit more things.
I can only talk from the player's perspective, and I like how this game organically grows. So it's not like I did not miss anything the first couple of hours. And with the speed of content that you are providing in terms of creating new content, I feel quite comfortable with it as well.
Oh, thanks.
Anything unannounced, maybe a little sneak peek for our listeners they can look forward to if they boot up Domekeeper from now on in, let's say, in 4 weeks, 5 weeks?
Yeah. So exclusive reveal. Yeah, we are working on now on something that a lot of people asked for, which is a new mode where you can basically just concentrate on the mining without monsters. So it's called the miner mode. At least it's called like that right now. And there you have a, we are still kind of in the design process for different goals, but also provide a playground just to do anything you want.
Nice.
We are also thinking about, for example, smaller kids. Like our daughter is 3.5 years old. She can't play with the monsters because she cannot handle the difficulty of the battle, but she enjoys actually mining. And she can do that. Yeah, that's the perfect mode for her. So that's also motivation to push that.
I don't think there's better motivation to include something like this. Great. Cool. So that's, yeah. You heard it here first, maybe. It depends on when I get to cut this podcast, but no, but I'll keep up. Yeah, cool. René, thank you very much for giving us some insights on your journey as a games dev and also on the earned success that you have with Domekeeper. For our listeners, if you have not played Domekeeper yet, it's available via Steam. I really cannot recommend it enough, and pick it up and have fun with it.
Yeah, thank you, Yves. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun to talk to you.